المكتب التعاوني للدعوة والإرشاد وتوعية الجاليات بأبها.
ادعو إلى سبيل ربك بالحكمة والموعظة الحسنة وجادلهم بالتي هي أحسن.
The question arises as to how are things for the Muslims in America? Who are the Muslims in America? A question that I run into sometimes being here in Saudi Arabia, when I first got here in the end of September, is the Muslims will ask me, in America, the beard, the thobe, the woman, can they wear the niqab, the hijab, you know? So I understand that there's a lot of misunderstandings about the status of Muslims in America and how the da'wah has been going there. And today, inshallah ta'ala, I'll be answering some of your questions, all right? So, the first thing that we have to understand about Muslims in the United States, right? The better term is the United States of America, because we're dealing specifically with North America, right? The first thing that we must understand is that Muslims have been there for a very long time. Muslims have been there since the 1600s, actually. Right? So, that being said, let me first go over an overview of the United States. The United States first started as a British colony, right? And the date of independence we have, it here at July 4th, 1776. The current population in the United States is 316 million. This was as of July 2013. The dominant language in the United States is English. However, there is no real official language. But most government work, statements done by the president, official documents, the English language is what is used. The religion with the most followers in the United States is Christianity. Most people will claim that they adhere to Christianity. Now, the important thing to understand about this statistic is that it is not taking into account people who might be practicing or not practicing. How it works is that when the statisticians go out to do the survey, they simply ask the question, what religion do you follow? What religion do you adhere to? And the people will answer, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism. So 76% of the population ascribes to Christianity. And the type of government. The type of government, right, is a constitutionally based federal republic. So what this means is that you have a constitution and it is the main source for legislation. In other words, no legislation that is produced or any laws that are produced can be conflictual with the Constitution. And it being a federal republic, it means that you have the states divided. You have 50 states in the United States, and each of them has their very unique set of laws for how they go about business, certain things in traffic, right? They have their own governor, right? But yet, they all must adhere to the Constitution, right? So, like I had said to you before, Muslims, being in the United States since the 1600s, right, came through the colonial path. So I will briefly go over some of the colonial history for you. Christopher Columbus' 15th and 16th century explorations. Now, Christopher Columbus was a person who was born in Spain. There is some dispute over where he was exactly born. But what happened is that he was campaigning in Western Europe to make a voyage to explore the New World, right? To see what was happening on the other side of the planet. And that being the case, after being denied many times by the rulership in the U.S., the European powers, I should say, my mistake, being denied the funding and the ability to make his voyage, right? He finally secured it, and in 1503, his second voyage arrived in Florida. Now, in the background, I have a light map here of the United States, and Florida is right here, this tip. So, when they arrived there, what they started doing, they started to explore, trying to see what was there, and they ran into Native American tribes. Many Native American tribes had already existed in this part of the world. So, a common misconception people have is that Europeans were the first ones to arrive here. And another misconception people have is that Muslims were not the first, were not on this side of the planet before. But this is not true. It is a little bit outside of my sphere of discussion for tonight, but there is documentation that Muslims had actually been to this region of the world, but yet they had not settled. They had not settled there. Before this time here, 1503, Muslims had arrived. An important thing to understand. But yet, they did not settle. That is the key thing. And in addition to Spain, you had Portugal, Great Britain, and France. So all of them were trying to secure their own piece of the pie, as you would call it, of the new land. Alright? Is everybody following me so far?
Yes.
Very good. Very good. So, the first Spanish settlement, the first permanent one, was established in 1565. It was not very successful because of a lack of participation. However, the first British settlement was set up in 1607 in Jamestown, Virginia. Right? So, the reason why you have two different settlements is because the Europeans were competing for who could control this new territory. Who was going to control the new world, as they would call it. Right? So, with further interaction with the Native Americans, many of the Native Americans died. The Native American population in the United States is extremely low. It's extremely low because of the new disease, the new European diseases that they had suffered from. The interaction with it, they did not have the immunity to survive it. Right? So, but yet, you still have a Native American population. So, if you're wondering right now why I'm mentioning this, you will see soon. You'll see why this discussion of Europeans competing is unique for Muslims arriving on this side of the planet. So, this is just a very quick map. It explains the European territories in the year 1750. So in 1750, you had the United Kingdom, Great Britain in the yellow here. You had France controlling this area, and the Spanish controlling much of what occupies this region, is Texas, and you have Mexico, and some of California. Right? So are everybody following me so far?
Yeah.
Right? Very clear?
Yes, sir.
Any questions? All right, no questions yet. Very good. Or the other area, much of this was eventually acquired by the United States government. Some of this region here was owned by the Spaniards, but eventually, over time, it was bought off by the United States, right? So, that's what happened. Because the British colony, right, over here in the yellow, that is what we can call the colony that survived and made it to independence, and what we know as the United States. Right? So, what happened because of this new colony is that people needed workers. Right? The new colony needed to have people to do their work. And a cheap way of labor is slavery. And the name of this slave trade, if you look it up in history, it is called the transatlantic slave trade, or the Atlantic slave trade, or the triangular trade. So I will go on more to explain this for you. So, other European nations, particularly the Portuguese, they had been using slaves for a very long time down in the region known in South America as Brazil, right? They were the first ones to start using it. So, other European nations had begun as well, right? Now the first time you have the British really using it is in Jamestown, Virginia, where I told you they had the first colony. So the British, the Spanish, the French, the Dutch, they were all involved in this use of slaves. But the important thing to remember is the first time it really happened here for the British, right, is in Jamestown, Virginia. So in 1619, a battered Dutch slave ship ends up on the shore in Jamestown, Virginia, right? So being that the ship was battered and they had slaves, right, they decided to barter food for slaves. So they exchanged 19 or 20 West African indentured workers. The first name that was given to them was indentured workers. And the meaning of indentured workers is, we will hire you for a period of years, and after that, you are free to go. So that was the first title that they actually fell under, right? So this was how they would solve their labor problem. Now in 1641, this is a very big day, because this is the date where slavery became a legal institution. This is the date where slavery became on the books as a legitimate way to perform business. So, that being said, what happened? This brought on a lot more use, this brought a lot more slaves into the country, right, because of the labor shortage that I mentioned here. So, what would happen, much of the South, the southern half of the United States, was used for agriculture because of the very good climate, right? The northern part of the United States is sometimes can be significantly colder than the southern half. So, that being the case, the South was involved in rice plantations, tobacco, and cotton. So these were three primary crops that they used to use, right? And this was part of the business trade, which I'm going to explain that later for you, how it would work. Because these three crops were primary for the economy of this of the new colony. So, like I said before, it gave the rise for a new, for the need of a new and strong labor force. Because the colonists had already tried using the Native Americans, and it was an utter failure. It just never worked. The Native Americans, many of them were rebellious, and it didn't work because of the diseases that they had contracted from their first interaction. Very good. So, the first Muslims. This is the exciting part, right? When we start to discuss the Muslims. Now, approximately 10% of all African slaves brought to the United States were Muslim, right? Approximately 10%. So you count 10 people, right? And one of them was a Muslim. By 1800, it is understood that there are over 500,000 slaves had arrived in the new British colonies. Now, what this means is that there are other British colonies in the Caribbean as well. You go down to Jamaica, you talk about Barbados, you talk about other regions in the Caribbean. And the Caribbean is this region down here. It's not on my map, but it is south of Florida. Everybody following me so far?
Yes.
Very good. So over 500,000 slaves had arrived in the new colonies. Very good. So some historians estimate that between 15 and 30% of all enslaved Muslims, all enslaved males were Muslim. Now, part of the problem in nailing down exact numbers is that slave traders did not really keep track of religion. That wasn't their business, right? Their business is to get people to the new territory and to have them working. But some of the historians, they estimate that between 15 and 30% of all enslaved males were Muslim. And approximately 15% of all enslaved females were Muslim. All right? So, that being the case, a substantial number of them came from Senegambia. And I will show you where that region is in just in a second. So this is unique, because the slave traders, they made notations on this, and they said that the Muslims were noticeable due to their education and determination. And in addition to that, some of them were very resistant to slavery. They were very resistant to what actually took place. And the sad part, right, a lot of strong efforts were made to suppress the practice of Islam. What would happen sometimes is that when slaves were moved from West Africa, right, to the newly formed colonies, is that they would break the family apart. If there was a family, they would break them up, and they'd send the son to another part of the state. They'd send the mother might work in a home, and the father, he might go another place 100 miles away. That is how it would work. And by doing this, this destabilized the central family unit of Muslim families that might have been there. Right? And also, what it does, it helps to stop the spread of Islam, because it is harder for people to educate their families. Right? And in addition to this, another thing that they would do is that they would make very, very, very strong efforts to convert people to Christianity. Right? That one could say that maybe if this did not happen, you might have more Muslims in the United States right now. Maybe one can make that claim. But Allah A'lam, but this is what happened. Right? So we're clear so far. The first Muslims arrived in the new colonies, and approximately 10% of the Muslims, of the slaves arriving in the United States, were Muslim. So this is what I wanted to show you. The triangular trade. So slaves were moved from this part of Africa to here and here. And the crops that I mentioned, the rice, the cotton, and the tobacco, they were moved from here back into Europe. Right? And then from Europe, they would process them and send them back into Africa. Right? So as you can see, this is a business. Right? That was the nature of the slave trade, right, in which Muslims were a part of. So this just shows you here some of the names of the old regions here, because some of the more recent names they weren't existent at this time. So you have Senegal and Gambia, right here. This is a very important place, because many, many, many slaves were taken from here, and this area here was predominantly Muslim. All right. Very good. So, we have notable Muslims of this period, right? And this is evidence of the existence of Muslims, clear evidence during this time. Because like I said in the beginning, sometimes there's a misconception. People think that Muslims just showed up, you know, near the fall of the Ottoman Empire, or post-World War II, or with the creation of the Israeli state. But Muslims have been in the United States a long time before that. So we have two slaves here, and both of them are Muslim. Both are Muslim brothers here. First one, his name is Ayub Suleiman Diallo. Right? And I'll briefly go over his interaction in the newly formed colony. So he was born in Senegal in 1701, right? He belonged to a very, very important family. In 1730, both he and his translator were captured by another tribe and sold into slavery. So another African tribe had caught them, and they sold them into slavery. Because like I said before, it is a business. So the reason why Ayuba Suleiman is important to us is because he is Muslim, and he's one of the slaves who wrote a first-hand account of what happened to him. Now, in that part of Africa where you had, you know, these big Muslim areas, you could call them Muslim kingdoms. A lot of the Muslims there, if they belonged to the upper class of the society, they could usually read and write Arabic very fluently. Right? So That being the case, he was one of the slaves who wrote a memoir. He actually wrote about his experience in slavery, which is unique. Because what would happen is that many slaves were not educated. When they came to the new colony, a lot of effort was made in making sure that they stayed uneducated, because that was one of the ways in which stability was maintained. So, after some time, while Ayub Suleiman was there, right, Thomas Bluett recognized he was of nobility. Now, Thomas Bluett was a lawyer. He was a lawyer, right, and he had spotted Ayub Suleiman. So in his interaction with him, when he saw him, he was saying, you know, he looks a little bit different. He doesn't match, you know, the attitude or what we understand to be the typical slave. So in his interaction, this is what he says. Upon our talking and making signs to him, he wrote a line or two before us. And when he read it, pronounced the words Allah and Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, by which, and his refusing a glass of wine we offered him, we perceived he was a Mohammedan. Now this is a name some of the European colonizers used to use for Muslims, because sometimes they didn't know the name. So they knew that these people, they followed Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, right? So this is a name that they would use sometimes. So, by which, and his refusing a glass of wine we offered him, we perceived he was a Mohammedan, but could not imagine of what country he was, or how he got thither. For by his affable carriage and the easy composure of his countenance, we could perceive he was no common slave. Now the English here is a little bit different, because it's older English. But what they're saying is that we notice that he is different. We notice that this is a different type of individual that we're dealing with. So, upon discovering his nobility, right, a letter was sent to the director of the Royal African Company. The Royal African Company was a company that was based out of the United Kingdom, Great Britain, and they were particularly involved in the slave trade. That was just the nature of their business. But what would happen when somebody would discover that you had a slave who was nobility? Sometimes they would make efforts to remove him from this condition, because they say in their head, well, you know, he's not like everybody else. You know, he probably can inherit a kingdom. So they made an effort to release him from that situation. However, not all the people at the time were on board with that. But you had some colonizers who did not have a problem. So he was sent back. He was then bought and sent to England. Soon after that, he was back to Gambia. He got back to his home country, right? So we have another one. He's very popular in African American history in the United States. Very popular in American history in the United States. His name is Abdurrahman Ibrahim Ibn Suri, also known as Prince. Born in 1762 to a royal family. Son of the King of Suri, modern day Republic of Guinea. He was a leader of his father's military division, right? And at the age of 26, in 1788, he was captured by a warring nation and sold into slavery, right? This would happen a lot. Different tribes, in order to make money, they would simply attack one another, enslave individuals, and then sell them to the European slave traders. And his story is very unique. He was enslaved for 40 years before he was freed and allowed to go back. 40 years. That's a lifetime. So, one day he is discovered by a doctor who he knew back in Africa. Right? And the doctor made an effort to try and release him. Try and get him back to his home country. So in 1826, he sent a letter to the Sultan of Morocco requesting that he and his wife be freed, right? Because the Sultanate of Morocco is how many nations would actually, particularly here in North America, communicate with the Muslim world, right? to the Sultan of Morocco. So the letter was sent and requesting his freedom. So he and his wife were released in 1829 on the stipulation that they go back to Africa and not live in the United States. There was a lot of repression in regards to releasing people of African descent in the United States from slavery and allowing them to live. There was a big problem with that. So his slave master said that, "I will release him on the condition that he goes back to Africa and not live in the United States." And his story, you know, is a little bit sad because he never actually made it back. He died before he made it back to his hometown. Right? So these are some of the stories of Muslims who are there. Right? Muslims who are a part of the American fabric. They are part of the history. So Muslim involvement in the newly created United States. Right? So not only were Muslims involved in slavery, but post-slavery. Right? So let us take a look. You had Muslims fighting in the War of Independence. The War of Independence is what took place when the newly formed colony wanted to be free. Wanted to be free from British control. Because like I keep saying, it was a colony of the British. Right? And this is an interesting one. I found this one very interesting. In 1777, the Sultan of Morocco, Muhammad ibn Abdullah, was the first nation to recognize the United States as a new nation. So the first country, the first land to recognize the newly created United States in 1776, was in 1777 by the Sultan of Morocco. In 1805, President Jefferson hosted an iftar at the White House for an envoy from Tunis, right? Tunisia. Very unique. So this is showing you that for the longest time, right? For the longest time, you know, in the United States, the government, some of the more important people, you talk about the presidents, they knew about Muslims. They knew about them and they had recognized them. So in 1776, John Adams, he writes about his thoughts on government and praises Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, right? So John Adams, the second president of the United States, he knew about the Prophet Muhammad and he gave him praises. In 1785, George Washington states the willingness to hire Mohammedans, right? And like I said to you before, this is a term, an older term that they use because they were not really familiar with the term Muslim, right? It was not in their vocabulary. But they did know, right, that these brothers, that they followed the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So they called them Mohammedans. In 1790, the state of South Carolina gave special legal status to some Moroccans, right? Because there was a relationship that was maintained with Morocco, right on that eastern tip of Africa, the western tip, I should say. Very good. And in 1797, President John Adams signed the Treaty of Tripoli after the First Barbary War, in which he states that the United States has no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of the Muslim men. So in 1797, you have the president stating that, listen, we don't have any problem with Muslims, right? There is no issue. And this is what he says. Very good. So, what do we understand? Right? How I did my presentation is that after every little section, we're going to have right here to talk, discuss the most important points, and you can ask me any brief questions you have. Right? Muslims have been a part of the American society since the 1600s. Right? Muslims have had an active role in American development. And the United States and states within it have recognized the legitimate presence of Muslims. So this has been done a while back. So for the United States in its history, the Muslims are not new to them. All right? Everybody following me so far?
Yes.
Questions? No questions right now? Okay, very good. Are you excited? Are you bored? And nobody's bored, right? I hope you're not bored. If it's bored, I'll try to, you know, make it more exciting for you. Very good. So, that is a unique picture. The oldest mosque in America located in Cedar Rapids, 1934. The oldest one they had actually standing. The oldest mosque they have standing.
Yes.
This Cedar, where is Cedar Rapids? Iowa, yes, thank you. In Iowa. Cedar Rapids is located in Iowa. Very good. So, Muslim migration. This talks about the migration from Muslims to willing migration of Muslims to the newly formed United States. Right? So, between 18 and 1924, you had many Muslims from Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Also other non-Arab Muslims as well. So, Arab non-Muslims as well. And many of them were seeking financial prosperity, right? That was the primary reason that is documented for their move. And this is also at the time where the Ottoman Empire wasn't doing so well. And many of them lived in cities, Michigan City, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Cedar Rapids. They congregated in these areas. They made an effort to stick together, which is very good. So, the next major wave is with the creation of the State of Israel. This initiated a major movement of Muslims from Palestine, right? Caused a lot of problems. A lot of Muslims started to migrate to the United States just because of the creation of Israel. Right? So in 1952, the McCarran-Walter Act relaxed the quota system of 1924, because in 1924, they had created a quota system. So, there were only a certain amount of immigrants allowed to move into the United States, right? So you had a high influx of immigrants, and what some of the historians point out, they mention the harsh regimes that were in Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. So many Muslims left these territories at that time. So in addition to that, we cannot forget South Asia, cannot be forgotten. Because many Muslims left South Asia, but as a historian state, it was primarily for economic prosperity. So you had two reasons for migration of Muslims to the United States. Economic prosperity, right? And also oppression, what they would call oppression in their homelands. Very good. So when we talk about South Asia, we talk about India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Many Muslims left that region. So, current Muslim statistics, right? I really love statistics. It's one of my favorite things in school. So let's take a look. North America, the estimated Muslim population in 2010 is 3.48 million, right? 3.48 million, right? And the total population in the United States is estimated in 2010, they were saying 344 million. This estimate is a bit high. Sometimes the estimate is high because what they do is they're adjusting for illegal immigration, people who are not on the books, right? People who are not registered in the country. So they estimate a little bit higher. So in 2010, we have Muslims making up about 1%, right? So I always like to think of it in easy terms. We have maybe 100 people in here, one person's Muslim, right? 1%. So, like I was saying to you before, sometimes the statistics are hard to attain due to a faulty surveying and unwilling participation. You know, because sometimes Muslims, they don't want to really give out accurate information, because how it works in the United States is that there is nothing that says you have to tell people your religion. There is no form that a citizen has to write to say, I am part of this religion or anything like that. So all the information presented is given willingly. Does everybody understand this?
Yes.
Exactly. So the statistics are based upon willing participation. Muslims actually saying, yes, I am Muslim. Right? So the Center for Immigration Studies states it's between 3 and 4 million. It is confluent with what we said before. It agrees with that. And the American Muslim Council estimates it's approximately 5 million. Right? So we can say between 3 and 5 million. Now that in itself is a big difference when we talk about these numbers between 3 and 5 million. However, right, we can say we have an idea of how many Muslims are in America, right? Maybe we can say at the high end 1.2%, right? So everybody follow me so far?
Yes.
Very good. Right? So, very unique statistics. Now these statistics here are coming from about 2010. And like I said to you before, some statistics are hard to gain because it takes willing participation, right? But 35% of all Muslims are born in the United States. So when you take a look at the Muslim population, right, you have a very big young population as well. 35% of them are born in the US, right? 24% are born in the Arab region. What that means, we talk about from Morocco, going to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, going all the way to Iraq, right? So 24% are born in the Arab region. 18% are born in South Asia. We talk about South Asia, we talk about Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, right? And the other 23% are of many different nations, some born in Iran, I'm not sure about the numbers here, in Europe and other parts of Africa as well. So, racial groupings. Racial grouping is something that the United States does to kind of understand, you know, the racial grouping that people ascribe themselves to. So, from what the statistics would say, 38% consider themselves white, 26% consider themselves black, 20% consider themselves as Asian, 16% consider themselves as another mixed race. So the amazing thing about the Muslims in the United States is that they have the religion that has the most diversity in terms of ethnicity and race, right? No other religion in the United States has this much diversity in regards to adherents. So distribution of mosques in America, this is very unique to me. I really love this. Now, like I said, I love statistics. So are you excited? Get excited, all right? So the dark blue means that we have 100 plus mosques in that state, right? And the very amazing thing showing you how Islam has spread, you know, by the permission of Allah. There is no area where you don't have masjids in America. There is no area, right? This little white area is not part of the United States. Every single state, you will find between 1 and 9 masajid. MashaAllah. Very amazing. In California, you have 100 plus masajid. Texas, 100 plus masajid. Illinois, 100 plus masajid. In New York, I'm sure you have made probably even over 200 masajid, right? And Florida as well. Florida was where I was based, and I know you have a very strong Muslim community there. So, in these other areas, you know, you have between 50 and 99. So this is to show you, Ikhwan, that Muslims are present in America. Without doubt, they're there. So we clear? So any questions on this? No questions? All right, very good. So what do we understand? There are a significant number of Muslims residing in the United States. They span a great deal of ethnic and racial groups. Muslims are the third largest religious group in the United States. So this is how it is. You have Christians, Jews, and then Muslims. So we are the third largest group in the United States. And, alhamdulillah, they've established communities, evident by the presence of the masajid, which is very good. So you can see that Muslims have established themselves there, Muslims who are born and who have migrated there. So, we are present. Any questions so far? Religion and the state. Now, this relates to the first question that I said some Muslims asked me. So, you know, Zayd, the beard, the hijab, is this allowed? So I'm going to answer that question for you right now. religious freedom in the United States. The freedom to practice one's religion in the United States rests in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. Bill of Rights is a part of the Constitution that deals specifically with individual rights. And it says here, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assembly and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Right? So therefore, Congress cannot make a law respecting any specific religion. Right? So the government has ingrained in its constitution, right, the fact that the state cannot endorse, cannot support, or prohibit any type of religion, or the freedom of speech. Right? And this is known as the Establishment Clause. Known as the Establishment Clause. It is where, a lot of the times when you have civil rights issues coming up in the United States, it is based upon the First Amendment. So, you know, you will have the case of, for example, you might have heard it in the United States, gay marriage. This is what they cite. Right? And because of the fact that Congress cannot make any law respecting any specific religion. So that allows Muslims to practice their religion freely. Right? Now, when there are some details that sometimes might cause problems, specific details, because when you have freedom of speech, people think that you can just go out and say anything you want, anytime you want. But it is not like that. Right? So, further on, I'll take some questions on that if you have questions, alright? So, the separation of church and state. Right? Part of this is based on something called the Lemon Test. What is the Lemon Test? This is based upon a United States Supreme Court case, Lemon versus Kurtzman in 1971. So the Supreme Court is the highest court in the United States, right? Usually, cases that go there, they deal with the violation of a person's civil rights that they have. And in the United States, these cases are very big because they change the history of the law, right? They change the course of the law. So, what happened was that the state of Pennsylvania had allowed for the reimbursement of teachers at non-public institutions, mostly Catholic schools. The court ruled that this was unconstitutional due to entanglement. Right? And what this means is entanglement is that the government is getting involved in religion. Right? So this is something that is frowned upon by the Supreme Court, right, and many areas in the government. So, it is based upon three prompts, three principles, right? The Lemon Test. So, for a law, right, to be allowed, it must pass the Lemon Test. What is the Lemon Test? The law must have been adopted based on a secular and legislative purpose. So, in other words, the law cannot outright ban any type of religion or make any type of, make any inference to any specific religion. Right? So the purpose must be secular and legislative. So the law must have nothing to do with religion at all. If it does have anything to do with religion, then it can be fought, brought to the Supreme Court, and overruled. The law's principles must neither advance or prohibit religion. So the law cannot, indirectly or directly promote or hinder religion. It has to be neutral, right? And the law must not result in any excessive entanglement with religion. Like I had mentioned to you before, the relationship between the Catholic Church and the school reimbursement. This is a problem. It cannot happen. So, what do we understand? The United States does not officially support or prohibit any religion or the propagation of it, which is very unique for Muslims because it allows us to propagate our religion and the courts can do nothing about it. Right? Based on the US Constitution and the Lemon Test, the United States government or any state government cannot officially support or prohibit any religion or its propagation. Right? So, in conjunction with the United States government at the federal level, at the top, you have the 50 states, and they all have their separate legislators and governors. Even in the states, they cannot do it, because everything must be in line with the Constitution and the Lemon Test. So Muslims are in a unique and advantageous position to give people da'wah, which is very good. Islamic activists and groups. I thought I'd mention this here, you know, just to talk about a few individuals that we have and groups that we have in the United States that deal with advocacy. Just to show that the Muslims are actively involved in many facets of American life. We have the Islamic Circle of North America, the Islamic Society of North America. Both of these organizations, what they do is sometimes they set up conferences to discuss issues taking place in the United States with Muslims, right? They also set up courses, right? They do, sometimes if you have a problem, you can go there and they can be your advocate. The Council on American Islamic Relations. The Council on American Islamic Relations, they are a special group dealing with advocacy. So if, for example, you travel to the United States, right? And you feel that your rights have been violated, you've been searched illegally, you are being mistreated because of your religion, because these things do happen in the United States, there's no doubt about that. This is the group that will sometimes get involved and they will be your advocates if you have problems. Right? So, the Muslim Student Association. The Muslim Student Association is very active on college campuses in the United States. And they're particularly involved in providing services for Muslims who are in the university system. So what they will do, like on the college campus, there might not be a masjid. They will pay for a room, they'll rent the room out, and then you have a masjid, right? Or they'll provide iftar services, or sometimes they'll provide Jummah, you know, if the other masajid are located far from the school. So in many facets of American society, Muslims are active. And we have some influential Muslim personalities. Some of them I'm going to mention you might know. Some of them you might not know. Jamaluddin Zarabozo. Jamaluddin Zarabozo is an individual that has translated many, many books from Arabic into English. And he has done a lot of Islamic propagation in the United States. MashaAllah, he's done a very good job. Right? Now everybody know this guy. Everybody knows this guy. Yusuf Estes. You know? Yeah, so I'll just tell you a little bit about him. Like, if you don't know, he used to be a preacher. He accepted Islam. And right now he does a lot of da'wah in the United States. I don't know how much he does now. And I'm not sure if he's in the United States right now. But I know a very influential person. Warith Deen Muhammad. Warith Deen Muhammad, right, rahimahullah, yes, he died, right, and he was a very influential individual because he was somebody that left the Nation of Islam. Now, the Nation of Islam was a pseudo-Islamic group. They were a black nationalist group that was around from the 1930s and they're still active today. And he was an individual who found true Islam, alhamdulillah. And he left them, and with him, many people left. Alhamdulillah, Allahu Akbar. So many people left with him, and he is a very influential character. Dr. Sherman Jackson. Dr. Sherman Jackson, he is a university professor, and he also does lectures. He speaks a lot about Islam, and he has a degree in Arabic, right? I'm not exactly sure he has his PhD in, but I know for a fact he's very, very popular in the lecture circuit, you know, talking to people about Islam and things like that. Oh, how much time do I have? 15 minutes. All right. 13? Okay, very good. So I'll speed it up a little bit. Right? Malcolm X, Al-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, rahimahullah. Right? very, very popular Muslim in the United States. He's one of the individuals who also left the nation of Islam and found true Islam. So his story is that he went on Hajj, the integral part of his story, and he saw the diversity of the Muslim nation, and he said to himself, man, this is amazing. This is what Islam really is. You know, and you know, very sadly he was assassinated a little bit after that. But you know, he's a very, very important person in the United States when we talk about Islam. Keith Ellison, Andre Carson, they're two individuals that are not so popular, but they're popular because they're the first U.S. congressmen, right? So they're actually lawmakers in the United States, right? Which is good in a sense because it gives the Muslims a voice in the government, right? So we have people there to petition on grievances, to deal with the problems that sometimes we have. So we have Keith Ellison, he was the first, and then Andre Carson was the second. Right? So, their importance, they demonstrate the active presence of Muslims in America, expose the masses to Islam, and provide support and education for Muslims. Very good. So, this is just an overview of why these groups and these individuals are important. So, yeah, Juan, do you have any questions? Questions right now?
Because we still have 20 minutes.
Yeah, I know, that's why I'm asking questions. All right, go ahead.
I could not understand that reimbursement thing.
Oh, the reimbursement, okay.
What was that thing you said
about? Okay, what happens is that you had non-public schools. You had schools that were private. In the United States, just like many countries, you have private and public schools, right? And what was happening is that Pennsylvania, a specific state, what they were doing, they were reimbursing teachers at the private schools, which was predominantly Catholic. So the government, pardon? Yes, yes, they were reimbursing it. So the government had gotten involved in taking care of private schools. Now, if you remember the principles I mentioned, the government cannot get involved in religion in any fashion, right? So what happened is that somebody filed a petition to the court saying that what this state is doing is illegal, right? And the Supreme Court overturned it and said what you're doing is wrong. You cannot reimburse these private schools, right? Because they call it excessive entanglement. The government is getting involved in people's religious affairs, right? And that is something which is not allowed. Clear? Any other questions there?
I think if you complete your slide, you allow
questions. Okay, very good. No, this one is finished here. Let me try and finish it then. Muslim-non-Muslim relations in the United States. Here I'm going to have a lot of statistics, right? Some of the statistics make me feel happy, some of them make me feel sad. But you know, I'll give you the reality. So, in 2010, the Arab American Institute, which is a group there in the United States, dealing with, you know, the particularly Arab population, right? They did a survey, and it was conducted by Zogby International in September 24th to September 27th, and they had 2,100 participants. Like I said, I really love statistics, all right? So I'm going to try and break it down to give you the idea of what they're really getting at, what these statistics mean. Please tell me your opinion of each of the following, right? Muslims. So 2,100 participants, they gave them a survey, and here it talks about their political affiliation, their age group. Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and the age group between 18 to 29, and the age group 50 to 64. So, they were asking, what's your opinion of Muslims? Is it very favorable or unfavorable? 55% said unfavorable. 55% of Americans said unfavorable, right? While 35% said favorable, right? Now, if we take a look at the age group here, right, you find 48% of the people who said favorable, right, they're 18 to 29. They're in the age group. And you notice there's a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. So that is something maybe I can discuss on another day, because that's a little bit more complicated. But I'll continue. So, unique question. Do you feel you know enough about Islam and Muslims, or do you feel you need to know more? MashaAllah, 49% said they're willing to say that they need to know more. So, almost 50% of the population is willing and ready. They say, yes, I need to know more. 36% said, I know enough. Khalas, I don't need to hear anymore. I know Islam well enough. And 10% said, I don't want to learn about it. 4% said unsure. So these, in my opinion, these are fairly good. Because you have some people who think, at least they think they know, and then you have people who would like to know more. And you only have a small percentage saying that they don't care. Right? Which is fairly good. It could be better, you know, but it's okay. Islam teaches people to lead good and decent lives. What do the people think of this? What do they think of this statement? 54% of them said they agree, which is very good. But 34% said they disagree. 12% are unsure. Right? So, this, in my opinion, right, is somewhat good in that the majority of people understand that Islam is a religion that is good. It is a religion that is beneficial. It has things to offer people. Right? But the bad side is that the amount of people who disagree, this is a high number. 34% is almost a third. Almost a third of people, you know, they think that they disagree with that statement. Islam is a religion of peace. Right? And this was a little bit alarming. 41% agreed. 47% disagreed. 12% unsure. So if you add up the people who disagreed and the people not sure, the bulk of them, right, are, you could say, in disagreement with that statement, Islam is a religion of peace. Right? But 41% of the people agreed with it. Islam teaches hate. Right? 46% agreed. Now, the thing to understand about surveys, because this was one of my areas in school, is that sometimes a statement, right, the people might understand a statement a certain way, right? If you ask some Americans, you know, what is hate, they will say that, well, Islam might be in disagreement with homosexuality. It might be disagreement with many things that take place in the United States. So to them, that is hate, right? That is part of the problem with at least this question, right? But as the survey has it, 46% agree, 44% disagree, 10% they are not sure, right? So let us continue. Now this one here is a little bit more recent. This is 2011, right? And this was very unique. This is the first time I had seen this survey. Americans vigorously support the idea of religious freedom, at least in the abstract. But when asked to consider the Muslim faith, many Americans express discomfort. And nearly half say that Islam is incompatible with American values. No. Many Americans agree freedom of religion is important. They say, yes, it is important. However, right, like you said, 88% of Americans agree that America was founded on the idea of religious freedom. Right? 88% of them. But Even though they say that, 30% say American Muslims want to establish Sharia. 41% are uncomfortable with Muslim elementary school teachers. 45% are uncomfortable with Muslim men praying at an airport, subhanAllah. 46% are uncomfortable with a mosque built near home. 47% say Islam and American values are incompatible. 48% are uncomfortable with Muslim women wearing the burqa. Or what they mean is the niqab, that's what they mean. So, you have a great deal of Americans who champion the idea of freedom of religion, but at the same time, they are not exactly comfortable with Islam. Right? At the same time, they're not comfortable. So what this shows is that for whatever reason, there is still a little bit of hesitancy about Muslim presence in America. Right? So, very quickly, hate crimes. I want to talk about this. What is a hate crime? Sometimes you hear about this in the United States. A hate crime, right, is defined in Congress as a criminal offense against a person or property motivated in whole or in part by an offender's bias against a race, a religion, a disability, an ethnic origin, or a sexual orientation. So, if somebody throws a bottle at you, or they go to your house and they put graffiti, just because of your religion, this is considered a hate crime, right? Specifically motivated by your race, your religion, your ethnic origin, sexual orientation, or your disability. FBI reports that there are 157 hate crimes against Muslims in 2011. This statistic is slightly lower than in 2010. Now, the United States Department of Justice estimates that the sad part about this is that the actual amount of hate crimes is actually maybe 20 times higher. So you times this number by 20 or 30, and that might be the true number because of the fact that some people don't report it. Some people don't go to the police and actually say, yes, a crime was committed. So the numbers, this only reflects what was reported. So I'll discuss this very quickly. We're almost finished. The anti-Sharia movement. There's a movement in America that is saying that the Muslims in America are trying to establish Sharia. They want to do all these things, you know, and they're actively involved in trying to stop that. They're actively fighting against something that is not really taking place, right? They're saying that they're trying to establish the Khilafah here in America, and they're doing all these things when this is not true. Not true at all. But what we have here is done by CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations. And the chart shows areas where they've made anti-Sharia bills. Bills just to make sure that the Muslims don't establish the Sharia, right? Which is not really taking place, but they just want to make sure. So here in Texas and Oklahoma, the bill passed. Where you see the red, it means they made a law. They made the law, and the law passed. So there's a law in Texas and Oklahoma and Tennessee and Arizona outlawing the Sharia, right? In the gold areas, they discussed it, but the bill died. They discussed it, and the law never passed. The people realize this law doesn't make any sense, right? The blue area, nobody's discussed it. This issue of Sharia in America is not important, alhamdulillah. You see, the bulk of them are blue. And that's why, and this goes to show you that there's diversity in America in regards to the attitudes of people. So, you go to certain areas, the people are very hesitant about Islam. You go to other areas, nobody really cares. It's not a big deal. Yellow, you have an active bill, which means they're discussing it, right? And like I said, the blue area, not an issue for discussion, right? Very good. But despite all of this, Ya Ikhwan, despite all of this, Islam is still the fastest growing religion. Allahu Akbar. So, the Association of Statisticians of American Religious Bodies states that between 2000 and 2010, the amount of Muslims residing in America increased by 1 million, bringing the total to approximately 2.6 million. Like, so, between 10 years, you've had an increase of over 1 million Muslims in America. Right? Now, only part here, I would have liked to see if I could find it. The difference between, is it because of birth rate or conversion? But I know for a fact that many, many Muslims are accepting Islam. Many, many people are accepting Islam, without doubt. But I just don't have the statistics to give you. So, that is that, or conclusions. Muslims, without a shadow of a doubt, are a part of the American fabric. We made that point clear, right? Based on population statistics, Muslim can become a key voting bloc, right? Which means that with the growth of the Muslim population, soon there will be a group of people that when people are running for president, they have to actually tend to their needs, right? And the nature of the United States legal system puts Muslims in a highly advantageous position, which means that they can... The nature of the United States legal system puts Muslims in a highly advantageous position. Because of that, they can spread the da'wah, like I said, the constitution and the lemon test. And more da'wah is always necessary.